Actually, Esme's off tonight. It's Moose Miller sitting in for Esme. We'll catch up with Professor David Schultz from Hamline University, professor of law, and talk politics. And that includes what's going on here in Minnesota and also just the events of this past week, once again, out of Washington. So we'll do that starting up around 8:35. Right now, we wanted to welcome a realtor who's out of the Houston area but has some ties here to Minnesota, as our topic is about housing and housing inventory that's now being affected by things like what's going on in Puerto Rico and how many people are going to be leaving Puerto Rico to come here in the U.S. and find a place to live or rent or buy. Hurricane Harvey. There's a lot of people that, you know, don't have a place to go back to with the flooding that happened in the Houston area. And then you go out to California, Santa Rosa, we're talking a huge number of homes, thousands of them that were burned to the ground. People got to find a place to live. How does that affect the housing market? Lance Loken is with us. Good evening and welcome, Lance.
Hi, Moose. Thank you very much. This is a huge honor. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, before we jump into the conversation at hand, your dad was on WCCO years ago?
Yes, he was. And he graduated from Brown Institute and grew up in the Faribault area.
Oh, that's awesome. Just awesome. So, you know the Twin Cities, and our market has just been on fire like a lot of markets. But, I've watched properties in South Minneapolis where, you know, somebody buys it and a year later they're selling it out because they thought they were going to stay there. But when they made some improvements to the property, and I'm not talking about flippers, I'm talking about people that had every intention of staying in there, but it would go up, you know, maybe $100,000 plus after taking out the cost of the improvements.
Right. Absolutely. I was up in the Twin Cities earlier in the year and spoke to several real estate agents, and they were expressing the exact same challenges that you're talking about.
Yeah, it's just, if you're a seller, it's a great place to be. But if you're a buyer or a first time home buyer, man, it I don't know how, people try to even stay in the game. I would think maybe now be the time to try to look for a place to buy, because maybe there's fewer, actual buyers out there because you're going to be heading into the holidays, which might be a little counterintuitive.
Right. Absolutely. Yes.
And with where interest rates are, they still seem to be hanging down 3.88, I thought I saw, for 30-year money. And, if we get a couple of interest rate ticks next year, even then we're still in the 4-5% range.
Right, and it's a great investment as well for right now, because several years down the road, the interest rates are going to increase, the inventory is going to go up, and you'll be in the driver's seat.
Yeah, as long as you're somebody that can find a good buy and isn't going to be somebody that gets, pulled into a situation where you're maybe overpaying for a property just to get it, and then if interest rates really take off, will you be able to sell it for what you bought it for?
Right. Good point.
That's the fear that I have is 2, 3, 4 years from now, if interest rates are back, because the first house I ever bought, it was in 1991. I had 9.5% interest. And I thought, man, that's awesome. Awesome that I could get that rate. Cause I remember watching, my parents, friends back in the 80s, when interest rates were, 16-17%, yep, people were doing home deals.
My parents bought a house at an 18% rate in Wisconsin. So, yes, I remember those days very well.
Yeah, and people that don't understand this, if interest rates, do continue to go up, the buying power of the buyers out there, the amount of money that they can borrow, that pool drops because you're now servicing more interest. So you have less money to really kind of throw at a property. And that's where I wonder, where are we going to be in this housing situation 5, 6, 10 years from now?
Well, in the Houston area, we're already seeing an inventory increase, and the buyers are being very picky on the choosing of their homes for that exact reason. They want the best of everything.
Well, and also you've also got a situation where there's pressure because so many people that may have lost a house now have to get things either rebuilt or they're going, screw it, I'm out. I'm moving somewhere else.
Right. Yes, we're waiting for the foreclosures to start happening. And what else is happening is the investors are buying on 50 to 60 cents on the dollar to these homes that were flooded.
Wow, sure, because they'll be able to fix it, rehab it, and then, you know, be able to rent it or, you know, eventually sell it, I would imagine. But we are really starting to enter into this period where, you know, the rental market is huge and continuing to grow in what used to be, you know, first-time home buyer housing.
Right. I read an article that was talking about the millennial generation, and they are taking longer and longer to purchase homes because they like to be in transit so often. And so they are definitely in the rental market right now. So to your point.
Yeah. What do you see, though, with, you know, when you look at Santa Rosa, which has got thousands of homes that are just burned to the ground? People, do you see, you know, like a migration effect? You know, I think of Puerto Rico with, you know, Hurricane Maria. There's a lot of people that may not come back to that island.
Correct. We have people that have already migrated to the Houston area and are looking at rentals from Puerto Rico. I have friends that are in the Santa Rosa area. And, you know, they're just trying to find a place to live right now because it was so decimated. That was a huge difference between Houston and there because those homes burned to the ground. At least here, all we had to deal with was flooding.
Yeah, and you know, ripping out sheetrock and getting it down to the
right
studs and then trying to, you know, mitigate out any mold and then, you know, move forward from there. And hopefully, you know, those units go back into inventory. But you know, as I look at some of this stuff, I go, wow, you know, there's already a shortage of good qualified construction people to begin with. And now you got more pressure to go into areas like Puerto Rico and Santa Rosa and parts of Houston and redoing roofs and you know, sheetrock and drywall. I would imagine going into 2018, this is going to start to play itself out in the housing real estate market.
That's exactly right. We've already seen, we had a record-breaking month for the month of September on the rental market in Houston, and I believe that's going to continue to happen, at least for the short term. And then these homes, it's going to take another 6 to 8 months before they get rehabbed, and then they'll be available next spring. But we're definitely in that hiccup type of an environment right now.
You know, for somebody that's listening in the Twin Cities or maybe knows someone that is thinking about jumping into, you know, the buying market, what advice would you give them? Maybe try to go out and get pre-qualified right now and maybe might be able to make a run heading into the holidays, or do you take your chances and wait until, you know, the big start next year, you know, when a lot of new inventory will come online probably here late February, early March?
Well, we're definitely telling our buyers to get into the home now for tax purposes because they can get some tax benefits before the end of the year. And I'd rather be in the market right now versus next year when the interest rates continue to increase. And we've been telling all of our buyers to get pre-approved. And there's actually a lender that we deal with that gets pre-approved fully, and they can buy a home and be in that home within 9 to 12 days. And so we really, you know, lead them in that direction.
Sure. And would you say that the process to apply in today's world is pretty streamlined, but yet still able to vet people out pretty thoroughly so that we're not, you know, creating another 2004 through 2006 where anybody right could fog a mirror qualified?
Right. Absolutely. Yes. The internet has done a great job with getting the pre-qualification process streamlined. You can actually go online and submit your application and get approved with information from your bank statements and such. So it has definitely been very streamlined.
One thing I've heard for first-time home buyers that, you know, maybe, you know, they don't have a precondition of, you know, trying to sell an existing home, so that kind of puts them in a good place, but maybe you know, they aren't as strong on paper with, you know, a down payment amount or something along those lines. But just writing a letter to the seller and explaining, you know, their world and what they want to do with that house, can that sometimes maybe push a seller towards them?
Absolutely. We have the buyer agents on our team. They actually write letters just like you stated, and they also submit photographs of the family and key characteristics of the family. If they've got two young children or three young children, they take pictures of them and how exciting it would be to have your home as the benchmark for growing up in that neighborhood.
Sure.
So, yeah, they absolutely do that all the time. And very importantly, you want to get with a good lender that has a true pre-approval letter that'll take you to the end. There's a lot of lenders still out there that'll pre-approve you and then take 45 to 60 days to close, and that just frustrates, you know, the sellers.
Sure. I've bought and sold six homes over the years, and the one thing that I always tell people that are going to go out and do this journey of trying to find a place to buy, get pre-approved with a mortgage broker or lender. I'm not a big fan of the big banks, but more so with the mortgage brokers that have a bigger, deeper, wider well of product to offer. The really good ones will vet out. They'll look at your pay stubs, and they will thoroughly vet you out so that there aren't going to be any surprises when you get closer to trying to close these things.
Absolutely. And I completely agree with you. Stay away from the big banks. The mortgage brokers and the lenders that specialize in it are absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. And you just ask around. Your realtor, if they're worth their salt, should know the names of some really good brokers that can, you know, because they scrub you over. They should, you know, because you want to make sure you're not going to run into any speed bumps or hiccups. They're going to, you know, kick the deal to the curb. And that brings me to, if you're a baby boomer right now and you're sitting in a pretty big home in some of these outer ring suburbs of the Twin Cities, what advice would you give to them? Maybe next year they should look at getting out of this thing, or, you know, because you wonder how long can you ride this ride, you know, with affordable money before that starts to dry up and go away in 4 or 5 years when they were thinking selling.
Yes, absolutely. I would start getting that ready so that when the springtime comes about, that you're fully ready to do that. Yes.
Because, you know, some of these homes, I just, wow, you know, they're huge, they're big, they're beautiful. But, you know, is there a growing pool of millennials or second time, you know, moving up home buyers to absorb that?
Well, I read an article a few months ago that this pool of new people coming in to purchase homes is larger than the baby boomers was. So
yeah, this pool of millennials, but they first have to get off the bench and get in the game.
Yes, absolutely. They do.
Yeah. But one of the things I've heard too, is that, you know, they're being encouraged, swing for the fences here, maybe go after the really big thing because, you know, 5-10 years from now, that may not be as easily attainable depending on where money is and where salaries are. Because if salaries don't go up or wages don't go up, you're not going to be able to afford more home as interest rates go up and push your pricing power down or your buying power down.
Right. And then we get right back into 2004 to 2007 again, don't we?
Yeah. That's, you know, exactly. And you know, I'll hold my breath and we'll see if, you know, a big tax cut, especially on the corporate rate for corporations, does indeed trickle down to the common employee or not. But I'm a little skeptical of that because there's been history on that hasn't borne true. You know, when you look at the Reagan tax cut on corporations, wages didn't go up that much. And in some cases, farther into that term of the Reagan years, wages actually started to pull back. And yet there were big tax breaks granted. So, you know, does that bear fruit? I don't know. And it's going to be interesting, but always a pleasure. And Lance, we certainly appreciate your time this evening here on WCCO.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much.
You've given us some good food for thought here. It's 8:23 on WCCO. We'll check some weather, see how the tailgate forecast is shaping up for tomorrow's Vikings-Ravens game. The Gophers won today over Illinois, 24-17. I'm Moose Miller, sitting in tonight for Esme Murphy here on WCCO. Moose Miller in on this Saturday night for Esme Murphy here on WCCO. There's a new survey out about millennials and Generation Z. Those are the people that are now just coming of age. Generation Z. Wow. When it comes to their preference on how they would like to communicate, most of the younger end of the millennial generation and the generation that's coming up behind them prefer to communicate digitally. 65% of millennials and those in Generation Z would rather communicate with people digitally than in person. And that's globally. Here in this country, it's 73%. 42% of younger people think it's okay to text during a family dinner. 27% think that it's fine to text someone while having an in-person conversation. Nothing drives me nuts more than that. It's like, really? I thought we were having a conversation here. And I just got done watching Blade Runner 2049, I think it was. The woman that has Ryan Gosling in it and Harrison Ford. And I'm just like, I hope that's not where we're heading, where AI and artificial intelligence melds with human beings. And that movie was so dark and depressing, and it's just, I wish I wouldn't have seen it. It's kind of like when I saw AI that had Haley Joel Osment in it, the young man who's now a young adult. He played a robot boy, or artificially intelligence created boy, that gets abandoned by the mother that had sought him out to replace the child they thought was dying, but then ended up getting better. And where that movie took us, that journey. Somebody told me, I guess they worked on that ending like 4 or 5 different times. And I still don't like the ending of that movie. And you wonder where does it all end up? And, you know, are we maybe going to see people start to push back and just go, enough is enough on digital input? You know, we need more analog. You know, I was telling somebody the other day, I'm so thankful I grew up in the 70s and the 80s, because I don't know what it's got to be like to be a kid today. It just, everything you see or do is captured and shared, whether you like it or not. And I don't know if that's healthy for the human being itself. You know, we do need some secrets. We do need some privacy, in my humble opinion. And I really wonder, you know, does that force us? This is a pretty heavy, deep conversation, I realize, but you wonder, as fast as things are going, and I think we're going to see some really remarkable things here in the next several years when it comes to artificial intelligence and just how rapidly that is growing, and will it be for better or for worse, is the jury's out on that, right? But, you know, I love watching old Friends episodes because they're not all sitting on those couches in the coffee shop looking at their phones. I remember that time. And, you know, you start to get a little older, you start to ponder and think about those things, but I really am worried for what we're creating with kids that only have a screen in front of them all the time. And I know parents are struggling and wrestling with that as we speak, but anyway, we'll check that WCCO weather forecast and see how we're looking for tailgate weather tomorrow for the Vikings and the Ravens next year on WCC.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Always enjoy visiting with our next guest here, Professor David Schultz, Professor of Law, Hamline University, who usually sits in with Esme Murphy here on WCCO. Good evening and welcome, Professor.
Thank you for having me, Moose. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing good. I got to tell you, as I was getting ready for our segment tonight, the one thing that really was rolling around in my head was General Kelly. And I wonder if he's sitting around this weekend going, man, I stepped in it. When I threw out that empty barrel comment, I now tripped into the level of what the president gets back and forth on a daily basis and trades in. And I think he really, in my eyes, reduced his value in currency with regard to a moral compass and the truth. Because I've always had profound respect for that man. But when I saw him head down that path on going after the congresswoman, I thought, don't get into this. That's not your world. The way he explained the soldiers and being brought back and the honor guard and the remembrance and wrapping them in a shroud, that was all such powerful, poignant, great things to remind us of. But to then head down that other path, I just thought, you're way out of your what you should be doing.
You know, it's interesting. I had very similar thoughts because among, I think, the best people in the Trump administration is General Kelly, who I think just you have to respect him in so many different ways. And then even if you don't respect, even if you didn't have enough respect for him, you also have to keep in mind that he also lost a son in the son. And so for on so many grounds, he's a hero. He's a hero. His family's a hero. And what bothered me with this whole story here is the fact that he knows also that Obama, going back to it, Obama actually did contact service members, actually, I think, did a pretty good job in trying to honor our fallen heroes. And I think you're right. He went down this path that he didn't need to do, and you sort of felt like he had to eat up a lot of his own integrity in the process to keep his job. And I would have rather have seen him either say nothing or be the good soldier, or perhaps resign.
Well, unfortunately, what's going to happen is the media is going to eat him alive next week because, there's video of this ceremony that was shot by the Sun Sentinel newspaper in Florida of this 2015 dedication. And nowhere on that tape is this congresswoman bragging about getting the funding.
I know.
And it's he didn't need to do that. Mm-hmm. And I hope to God he stays there with Trump because we need him there. And, and H.R. McMaster, we need him there. Mm-hmm. And it really worries me because, if people like that end up leaving the fold, God help us here. There's a lot of people that support Trump and have voted for him, and I totally respect and understand the probably the reasons that went into that vote, and rightly so. We gotta clean the swamp, drain the swamp, but I have yet to see anybody taking a move in that direction.
No, I agree. I was also going to say that that there are many listeners out there, who didn't vote for Trump. But at the end of the day, as Americans, you want to hope your president succeeds. You want to hope our government succeeds because that's the right answer when you think about it. It's really the right thing to say. And you're right. People like Kelly right now, I feel like, are one of the few people who are keeping this administration from completely going over the edge, especially when we think about like international events at this point in terms of how precarious things are with North Korea and Iran and so forth. And so I wanted to succeed, but I just had this feeling, I think you're right, that what we're going to see in the coming week here is just incredible battering of his integrity. And you sort of wonder if he now is going to be like Jeff Sessions is, like Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State, where one of my students called it this week. They're zombies. They're like the living dead. In the administration, and you worry that Kelly's going to go that route too.
Well, the other concern here is because they're still, very understaffed in this
Trump White House and these different cabinet positions and undersecretaries, and you go farther down the food chain. I just read today where the president himself has spent almost $500,000 of his own money to help pay the legal bills of some of the White House staff and campaign aides that are now being, you know, drawn into this Mueller investigation. And that's got to scare the hell out of any potential people that would maybe consider working for this administration because they don't want to get sucked into this.
I think you're right. I've seen a couple of stories, actually, in a variety of places, like The Economist. I think The Washington Post has talked about that also, is that you've got two things going on here. One is the Trump administration moving actually very, very slowly to fill critical positions. I think some of the listeners know, you know, that I do some speaking for the State Department. They send me on some you know projects occasionally, and so I know the State Department relatively well, and that's vastly understaffed in terms of areas. So one, he's not filling them, but B, there is this reluctance right now, I think, for many people of getting sort of caught in, you know, almost like a meat grinder or something like that, in terms of what's happening. And so I think this is going to hobble his administration, you know, for quite a while. And one of the things that I'm still not seeing after almost 10 months in office is his administration learning from past mistakes, going through the learning curve, and getting better at what they're doing.
Well, even his most ardent supporters say, knock off the tweeting, and he just can't stop. And it with this Florida congresswoman, it's like, dude, stop.
Yep.
You're feeding a cat here. It's not going to get better for you. You're only going to end up looking even less presidential than I think a lot of Americans look at him and just go, what the hell are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, let's focus on tax policy. Wasn't that what we were supposed to be doing this past week?
Yeah,
and where is that?
Yeah, and that's one of the big things that he wants to move on here, and he has potentially some momentum on it too, because the Senate passed a resolution in terms of saying that to move forward.
Oh, on the budget.
Right, on the budget, and it looks like he might have enough votes in the Senate to move on this issue. But what he has to still figure out how to do is, as they say, the devil's in the details. Work out the details. But what seems to happen? I mean, think. Look what we've seen before. As soon as he gets close on a deal, he starts to fight with the people he's closest to. And so, for example, you know, we know he's been picking on recurrently Mitch McConnell and Speaker Ryan. He looked like he had a deal with the Democrats on DACA and a couple other things. He at the last minute, he sort of picks on them or picks a fight. This week, it looked like the Republicans and Democrats did what they're supposed to do. What was it? 21 senators, whatever the number was, said they had a deal on a fix for Obamacare. And the Trump administration doesn't seem to want to go along with that. He just seems to be alienating at the point where he's just about to get success.
Yeah, I don't understand it. And then I'm reading here tonight where the House is considering cuts in the tax-deferred retirement savings. So the deduction on how much you could, you know, take against your income for a 401k or a Roth IRA or that kind of stuff. You know, that's middle America.
That's right.
Man, I mean, so now you're going to put that cost on us you know, and you know, what about the 1 or 2% out there? So they're going to get a bigger tax cut? Do they really need it?
Yeah, they don't really need it. And I think one of the other things that we're seeing is that they're talking about getting rid of the estate tax, you know, and I don't know about you. Maybe you can help me out here. Do you know very many middle-class people who can basically, at the time when they die, give away $5.5 million in terms of their estate?
Only farms, only family farms that I know of. And that's, you know, a $6 million farm is a pretty good-sized operation. I mean, that's a lot of ground.
You're talking
1,000 plus, probably closer to 2,000 acres, depending on how much the price of ground is going.
Yeah, we're looking at very few people affected by it. It's the same thing. A tax cut that doesn't really benefit the middle class. You're right, the one that you were talking about doesn't benefit the middle class. There's very little out there that's really benefiting the middle class in terms of the tax policy he's talking about. And these are the people, you know, these sort of the struggling, you know, middle class, maybe say the lower working class, these are the people who voted for Trump, and they're not getting very much, you know, out of this deal. And so combine that with the fact that some of the cuts potentially that he's proposing to the subsidies, you know, for low-income people who are on the getting their insurance through Obamacare, and a lot of people who voted for him are going to be hit pretty hard in the next year.
Yeah, where are we here in Minnesota on that with MnSure? I mean, what's going to become of, you know, those matching dollars and or dollars that, you know, help make up the gap or the difference so that somebody could afford a health care policy?
Yeah, this is going to be a big problem because, well, remember, was it last year, Mark Dayton said that the Affordable Care Act has become unaffordable. We saw in some parts of the state of Minnesota some insurance rates going up pretty dramatically. The Republicans came up with a fix to try to cut down on some of those rate increases. If Trump's proposals go through, it'll effectively negate that fix that the Republicans and the Governor Dayton came up with. And so we could very well see in a year from now us going back to those double, not triple digit, you know, rate increases in terms of insurance.
Sure.
Now, granted, it doesn't affect a lot of people, but it predominantly affects people where? In rural Minnesota, in places where there are not much competition in terms of insurance carriers. And so our insurance system in the state, which is actually pretty good, could be seriously damaged, you know, by some of those proposals that are going through.
Well, you know, I can tell you, you know, firsthand in my world, I'm self-employed, right. I'm 54 years old, and my health care is going to go up dramatically when I, 55 plus,
right.
When that day comes. But, you know, you're looking at $2,000 a month for a good plan.
That's right.
To cover just my wife and I. And I want to repeat that, mm-hmm. $2,000.
Yep.
And, you know, I want to throttle some of these people that are griping and whining because they may be paying $800 a month. And, oh, my God, my plan's gone up. Really?
Nope.
Do you even have a dog in this hunt?
Yeah.
And, you know, if you've got employer-subsidized health care, you don't know what you're talking about. You know, and yes, your plans are going up, but you have no idea what those of us on the individual market pay. And with all due respect, you need to educate yourself before you start chiming in on this debate.
Yeah, you make a good point here. One of my students who graduated last year was from Greater Minnesota. I won't mention the town because it's very small. And her father had a small farm, and she was talking about her father. Her father, mother, her, and like her sister, it was about $5,000 a month.
Yeah,
because they're
buying it on the individual market.
Exactly.
You know, why can't I get a chance to buy into a government plan, mm-hmm. like what our Senate staff is allowed to participate in?
Yeah.
Or, if you're retired from a government job, those people are paying, you know, in some instances, I have friends, I'm not going to name names, but they're paying maybe $400 a month, and they've got incredible health care. And I'm going, what gives?
Yep. No, you're right. I think one of the things that we've seen in the last 6 to 9 months here is that we went from a majority of the American public not supporting Obamacare to a majority now are saying, okay, maybe it doesn't work the best in the world, but let's fix it. And the thing is, there are a variety of fixes that we could put together at this point to sort of, you know, to improve it. Because I think at the end of the day, you know, I think most Americans say that we really, all of us ought to have health care insurance, and it ought to be affordable, and ought to be something that works. And I'm not seeing the Trump administration really moving us in that direction, even though he promised to say, get rid of Obamacare, what was his phrase? I'm going to replace it with something terrific. We've
yeah.
never seen a quote, a terrific policy proposal come from the Trump administration. And
well, they'll be able to sell that through the 2018 midterms, I predict. They'll still be able to trade on the currency of, you know, it's Obamacare, we're trying to fix it. But after that, I see you're going to own it. And then, you're the dog that caught the car.
That's
okay?
Right.
You caught the car, now do something with it.
No, I think you're right, because at some point we're going to get to a point, and I'm not sure where it is, where he's not going to be able to blame anything on his predecessors anymore. Because I remember Obama did a little bit of that when he first took office also.
You bet he did.
Bush. And at some point, it's like, you're president, you're responsible. It's like you said, it's your car at that point. You've got to solve these problems. And you're right, Trump's sort of reaching the point where he's run out of excuses on just about everything.
Well, here's the one thing that I hold out hope, at the end of the day, Donald Trump isn't loyal to anyone but Donald Trump.
Right.
So he may sell the Republican Party down the river to close a deal on, you know, what could end up being pretty damn close to universal health care. Mm-hmm. Because we've tried every option, and this is all we can come up with. You forced me into this.
Yep.
I could see that day. I really could.
Yeah. But if it happens, do you think it happens before 18 or after 18?
Because I think it happens after 18.
I do, too. Because if he's thinking about running for re-election, he does something bold, and he does something like that as an effort to try to sort of seal the deal going into the 2020 elections.
All right. Well, that's a great place to leave this conversation.
Great.
And we'll see what becomes of that. But you heard it here first. Professor, always a pleasure. I really appreciate your time.
No problem, Moose. Talk to you soon. Good night.
Professor David Schultz from Hamline University, Professor of Law here on WCCO. Our McCarthy Auto World time is 8:53. Certified McCarthy Cadillacs now up to 40% off MSRP. Shop McCarthyAuto.com. That's McCarthyAuto.com. Wow, where did the evening go, huh? I want to thank Kevin Reed right there working hard behind the scenes making me look good. I'm Moose Miller sitting in tonight for Esme Murphy. Jill on Money is coming your way after we check in with CBS World National News. Jill Schlesinger from CBS as we normally check in on that show on Saturday nights starting at 9 o'clock. Thanks for allowing us to spend a little time together here on WCCO.